It may be argued that providing for the common defense is the first duty of the national government. Nothing else the government does really matters unless our citizens can be defended from hostile attack. Not domestic freedom, because without the means for protecting it, it can be taken away. Not even peace, because peace without the means to resist foreign domination is just another formulation for slavery. Tacitus said of the Roman legions that they have made a desert and call it peace. The man President Bush has entrusted with our common defense is our speaker at this session. When Ronald Reagan set out 9 years ago to repair years of neglect to our defenses, one of his three or four key allies in the Congress was Dick Cheney, then chairman of the House Republican Policy Committee. And from that leadership position in the Republican minority, Congressman Cheney helped forge coalitions that sustained the Reagan defense buildup in the face of a hostile Democratic caucus. And the consequences of that sustained effort are historic. In conventional terms, the armed forces have been brought to peak readiness, as we saw very recently in the operation in Panama, which Dick Cheney directed. In strategic terms, the credibility of our nuclear deterrent has been restored, and with an emphasis on technologies that have leapfrogged Soviet capabilities, technologies such as stealth and such as STI, and there was no more vociferous champion of STI in the American Congress than Dick Cheney. In geopolitical terms, we have ended our policy of containing communist expansion in favor of the Reagan doctrine of promoting freedom behind communist lines. The military buildup then, with its emphasis on new technologies, intentionally put additional pressure on a communist system that was already beset by economic crisis. So by the time Gorbachev came to power, he was standing atop an edifice that was crumbling beneath his feet. But there was a silver lining for Gorbachev, because he knew that if only he could acquiesce to American maneuvers quickly enough, and if only the captives in Eastern Europe would revolt with sufficient alacrity, there was still time that he might be named Man of the Decade by the discerning editors of Time magazine. Conservatives were delighted when President Bush named Dick Cheney as Secretary of Defense. Now, a man who was intimately associated with that Reagan buildup that has brought so much good into the world is in charge at the Pentagon. If anyone can manage the situation in which we find ourselves, which is an embarrassment of riches, really, the situation where our enemies are in such complete disarray, if anyone can manage that situation without ourselves falling into disarray in the process, that man is our speaker at this session. Federalists, I give you the former six-term congressman from Wyoming, the former chief of staff to President Ford, and the man who, as much as anyone in the Congress, made Gorbachev the man he is today, Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ken. I really appreciate that warm introduction. And it is a delight to be with you here today. There was a time early in my career when I found it very difficult to get to large gatherings of attorneys to let me come speak to them. That had something to do with the way my career began as a congressman, as a politician. I wasn't going to tell this story today, but I related it to Terry O'Donnell, who many of you know. He's the general counsel of the Department of Defense. On the way over in the car, and he said he thought it would be appropriate. So I thought I'd share it with you today. But I did have difficulty earlier in my career getting invitations to speak before legal groups, because when I ran for Congress the first time, I beat several attorneys in order to capture the nomination and then the election. I like to tell the story that happened to me, a true story. As I began my campaign, that first campaign, I was in January up in a place called Dubois, Wyoming. I don't know how many of you know Wyoming, but Dubois is a small community up behind Jackson Hole in the high mountain country. And in January, the snow is about hip deep, and there's absolutely nothing to do in Dubois in the wintertime except go down to the Ram's Horn Bar and Grill, where everybody goes for lunch every day. And when it was my time to go work the community of Dubois, I went down to the Ram's Horn Bar and Grill at noon, where all the local elite were assembled, and was introduced around as Dick Cheney, a young candidate for Congress. And there was an old cowboy over at the bar, had his boot up on the rail, cowboy hat pulled down over his eyes. Looked over at me, said, "Son," he said, "you a Democrat?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Are you a lawyer?" I said, "Nope." He said, "I'll vote for you." So I told that story all over the state of Wyoming, and that's how I won my campaign. It was 5 years before the Bar Association invited me to speak to them. But we had a great time, and it is good fun to be here today, and this is a very important group because I know the enormous contribution the Federalist Society has made, and the contributions in terms of our basic fundamental understanding, I think, of the nation's constitutional heritage. That's been a major contribution, and it is indeed, and I say it with all sincerity, an honor to come spend some time with you this afternoon. I think this conference on the presidency and the Congress is an important one. It's a subject near and dear to my heart, and I thought I'd spend a few minutes this afternoon, I could, on a couple of important items that I think bear consideration given our current state of affairs. As James Madison tells us in Federalist Number 47, no political truth is certainly of greater intrinsic value or is stamped with the authority of more enlightened patrons of liberty than the truth underlying the separation of powers. Today, I want to talk about two major separation of power issues in national security policy, the notification of the Congress of special intelligence activities, and the war powers. But first, I want to begin with a preliminary observation. Edward Corn, as many of you, I'm sure, are familiar, a legal scholar once wrote that the Constitution is an invitation to struggle between the executive and legislative branches over foreign policy. And there has been plenty of struggle over the last 200 years of American history. But it would be a mistake to conclude that the Constitution simply distributed the foreign policy powers at random. The powers are distributed according to a fairly consistent set of underlying principles. Broadly speaking, the Congress was intended to be a collective, deliberative body. The presidency, in contrast, was designed as a one-person office to ensure that it would be ready for action. Its major characteristics in the language of Federalist Number 70 were to be decision, activity, secrecy, and dispatch. The government works at its best when both branches contribute according to their respective designs. And when that happens, the Constitution, to paraphrase a forthcoming Brookings Institution book, can be an invitation to comity and not just to struggle. Unfortunately, the relationship was one of enormous struggle in the 15 post-Vietnam years of the Carter, Ford, and Reagan administrations. Rather than each branch playing to its unique strength, each seemed increasingly to be convinced that the other was trying to do everything by itself. Today, 1 year into the administration of President George Bush, I can say that both branches seem to have taken some steps to improve the situation. Congress deserves some of the credit for helping lower the temperature, but I work for the president, and I want to tell you something about the way President Bush has conducted himself. The president has clearly used his powers decisively, prudently, and well. He also has made clear his view of his responsibilities and has been willing to assert his constitutional authority in the fields of national security and foreign affairs. The president genuinely respects the role of the Congress, but he also has decided to stand up forthrightly to preserve the powers of his own office. He's convinced that all branches have to work well for the government to work well. He's also convinced that Federalist Number 51 is right, that if he does not stand up for the presidency, no one else will. Paradoxically, it turns out to be easier to reach workable accommodations with Congress when the president is firm. Unfortunately, the general improvement in atmosphere has not brought about a resolution on all major issues. Let me note two outstanding examples. As I mentioned earlier, the war powers and the notification of Congress on special intelligence matters. Under the 1980 amendments to the National Security Act, the president's required to notify Congress before beginning any significant intelligence activity. But the law also allows for situations in which prior notice will not be given. When that happens, the law requires the president to fully inform the intelligence committees in a timely fashion. You will remember, of course, that one of the big issues in the Iran-Contra investigation was the fact that President Reagan waited 11 months to inform Congress about the sales of arms to Iran. After the investigation, many members responded with a classic example of what I call never again legislation. By never again legislation, I mean legislation that reacts to a past decision by trying to make it impossible for any president to make the same decision again, no matter how the world might change or whatever future circumstances might arise. The way Congress has been thinking of saying never again to Iran-Contra is by passing a bill that would require the president, under all conditions, with no exceptions, to notify Congress of all special activities within 48 hours. In 1988, the bill passed the Senate, but never reached the floor of the House. In 1989, the issue was revived as part of the Intelligence Authorization Act. That year's round produced a compromise that the president believes protects his interest. However, Intelligence Committee members have said they will address the issue again in 1990. Generally, there is no problem with notifying Congress before an operation starts or very soon after it begins. But no president can accept a statute that conflicts with his constitutional responsibilities. This is not just a hypothetical possibility. For example, the preparations for the aborted Desert One rescue attempt during the Iran hostage crisis of 1980 began months before the helicopters lifted off. Under the draft legislation, you could argue that Congress would have had to be notified within 48 hours of the start of the first phases of the preparation for the operation, long before the actual rescue attempt. Imagine trying to maintain tight operational security for that long. And while you imagine it, remember that the lives of the hostages and the agents involved are in the balance. Then there was the courageous Canadian decision to hide and spirit away from Iran a handful of Americans who were lucky enough not to be captive inside the American embassy. This included some U.S. intelligence support activities. According to an August 16, 1988 letter from Secretary of Defense Carlucci to Senator Boren, Chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Canadians asked us to hold off notifying Congress, and we did so. It's worth remembering the atmosphere in Tehran at the time. It is clear the Canadians were putting their entire embassy staff at peril in order to help us. When foreign governments place a condition on the United States, we can either accept the condition and go ahead with the operation or say no to both. In this case, we are talking about allies who were risking their own lives at no benefit to themselves to help save American lives. And because the president has the ultimate responsibility for protecting American lives, I believe the decision to withhold notification in these kinds of cases, as well as others, has to be his and his alone. Let me stress that what I'm talking about here is a rare situation. The problem is that the situations will vary from case to case. If Congress tries to define everything in advance by law, it will fail to provide enough leeway for action when it's in our national interest. This is clearly not what the Constitution intended. Ultimately, the conflict should be resolved by relying on appropriate political checks and balances instead of unwieldy and inappropriate legal ones. We believe that the appropriate standards were laid out in an October 30th letter President Bush sent to the chairman and vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. In the letter, the president said, and I quote, "I intend to provide notice in a fashion sensitive to congressional concerns. I anticipate that in almost all instances, prior notice will be given. In those rare instances in which prior notice is not provided, I anticipate that notice will be provided within a very few days. Any withholding beyond this period would be based upon my assertion of the authorities granted this office by the Constitution." End quote. Two aspects of that letter are important. The first is that the president has been and will continue to be sensitive to Congress's needs. But that sensitivity is only half the point. The other half is his firmness about protecting the institution of the presidency. We hope the two aspects together will convince Congress to drop the issue this legislative session. Let me turn now to war powers. I do not think I have to remind this conference that every president since the 1973 War Powers Resolution was passed has believed it to be unconstitutional, impractical, and even dangerous. Of all the resolution's provisions, the most insidious, perhaps, is the 70-day clock, excuse me, the 60-day clock. That provision purports to take away a president's power to use troops after 60 days unless Congress affirmatively reauthorizes an extension. Given Congress's tendency to delay and then reach short-term halfway compromises, what a 60-day clock would really do is tell an adversary how long it has to last in order to wait us out. A growing number of members of Congress may be coming to understand the 60-day clock's impracticality, but we are far from an agreement about its constitutionality. Meanwhile, we have a responsibility to try to make the government work despite the constitutional impasse. For example, every president has rejected the resolution's constitutionality. Therefore, none has issued reports to Congress that he has been willing to describe as being under or pursuant to its requirements. But these same presidents have sent reports that they describe as being consistent with the requirements. The differences, of course, between the words consistent with and pursuant to make little difference practically, but it gives all the difference in the world when it comes to defending executive power. The intention to notify is expressed, but in a way that preserves presidential prerogatives. The most recent report consistent with the War Powers Resolution came during Operation Just Cause in Panama 4 weeks ago. As you know, H hour in Panama was at 1 a.m. in the morning of December 20th. And to remind you of the immediate background, on December 15th, at the instigation of General Manuel Noriega, the Panamanian National Assembly declared that a state of war existed between Panama and the United States. On the 16th, a U.S. Marine officer was killed. A U.S. naval officer was beaten, and the naval officer's wife was detained, threatened, and abused. These events were not isolated. Since February 6th of 1988 in Panama, there were threatened almost 100 Americans with serious bodily harm or death. In addition, there were more than 1,400 violations of the Panama Canal treaties over that two-year period of time. All of this meant that the lives and welfare of American citizens in Panama were increasingly at risk. They also made it clear that the continued safe operation of the Panama Canal, the integrity of the canal treaties, and the security of American interests flowing from the treaties were all placed in serious jeopardy. Under these circumstances, the president ordered military operations. A few hours before H hour, President Bush notified congressional leaders of his decision. Then on December 21st, well within the 48-hour period specified in the resolution, he sent a formal letter of notification. Most members of Congress have supported our action in Panama. That usually happens when a president's decisions work out well. But there was some criticism about the way the president notified the Congress. Some members said that the president should have consulted and not merely informed the Congress. Moreover, the frequently heard congressional definition of consultation is that it should be a meaningful deliberation in a group setting in which the members have an opportunity to advise the president whether he should go ahead with a planned operation. With all due respect, I cannot accept this position, and I do not think any president could either. Remember, the claim is that the president has an obligation to consult. That word obligation is significant. The claim is not merely that it would be useful to consult or that the president would benefit from getting other opinions. I'm sure that President Bush would agree that oftentimes the advice of congressional leaders is very valuable indeed. In practice, he does tend to consult when, to paraphrase the statute, it is possible to do so. Clearly, however, the issue is not about advice, but rather about power and authority. Congress can properly demand a consultative role in advance of a decision, as opposed to asking for one, only if the power to make the decision is Congress's and the President is exercising the power because Congress has delegated it. That is the underlying theory of the War Powers Resolution. It is not the opinion held by this or any previous president. Let me emphasize that President Bush often does find it useful to have a give and take with members of Congress. The administration had an extensive and ongoing dialogue with Congress for months about Panama. But the decision for action finally belongs to the president. He is the one who bears the responsibility of sending young men and women in harm's way. If the operation fails, it will be his fault. I have never heard one of my former colleagues stand up after a failed operation to say, "I share the blame for that one. I advised him to go forward." The sad track record too often shows members hedge their bets at the start of an operation, waiting to see how it turns out before committing themselves. If the responsibility for decision is the president's, then the responsibility for gathering advice must also be his. However useful it may be to get members together for a group consultation, history shows that hastily called group meetings can produce rampant press speculation about what is going on. For example, when President Reagan briefed senators before the 1986 Libyan bombing raid, the senators had to dodge reporters' questions after the meeting. I am not about to claim that this particular chain of events caused security problems. Press speculation about a reprisal raid against Libya was already widespread. However, you can easily imagine similar situations in which a group meeting followed by no comments would raise press suspicion. With today's worldwide electronic media, those suspicions could easily beat our airplanes to the target. Of course, presidents often conclude that a meeting is worth it despite the risk. But balancing the risk is a judgment call. That judgment should belong to the person who has to order the risk in the first place. I realize, as soon as I make this point, of course, that many members of Congress will disagree. We can spend the next 10 years fighting over the point, but if we do that, I guarantee you the country will be the loser. The United States cannot conduct a successful foreign policy if every constitutional disagreement is pressed to a final confrontation. The legislative and executive have to agree to disagree and then work together to govern. We made some real gains in 1989, but we shall have to work hard to hold on to those gains and to keep moving forward. The United States is a global power with global responsibilities. Our post-World War II role has raised the foreign policy stakes for all Americans, and we are now entering a time of unusual uncertainty, opportunity, and risk. We know from our history that no policy can be sustained for the long term unless it has the active cooperation and participation of both branches. Now, of all times, it is crucial to contain disagreement. When the stakes have to do with the leadership of the free world, we cannot afford to be paralyzed by an intramural stalemate. Thank you.
Secretary Cheney has agreed to take questions.
Mr. Secretary?
Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is David Wecht. I'd like you, if you might, to distinguish or to reconcile our government's criticism of the Israeli government's capture of Hezbollah chief Sheikh Obeid with our own government's capture of Manuel Noriega, and going back, our own government's capture of Fawaz Yunus. I might point out that both the capture of Obeid and the capture of Noriega were undertaken by those respective governments in their own neighborhood and in areas where military operations were active and ongoing. I wondered if you might comment on that.
I don't believe you ever heard me criticize the Israeli action.
Oh, okay, could you, thank you. I suppose then perhaps you could comment on the criticism.
No comment. Yes.
Yes. The Constitution of the United States specifically and deliberately says that the Congress shall declare war. Obviously, every time the Congress meets, people know about it. The Founding Fathers clearly understood that. Now, if the United States has the right to, under the sole authority of the President, to secretly, with essentially no notice whatsoever to Congress, invade Panama, what limitations are there, if any, to invade any other country, say Colombia, where there are many people under U.S. indictment right now?
Well, I think the fact of the matter is that the President has vested in him the authority to use the resources that have been, in effect, provided by the Congress, in a sense. They've raised the army and provided the resources that have been used for the purposes, in the case of Panama, that President Bush stated, and on other times as other presidents have as well. You simply do not have time in each instance when you're dealing with those kinds of circumstances to seek, if you will, a resolution of a declaration of war from the Congress of the United States. And I would argue that the way in which the offices were created, as I mentioned in my speech, sets up a situation in which the presidency clearly is the institution, if you will, that is best suited for decisive action when that's required. Right now, today, as we meet, of course, the Congress has paid for, and we have deployed massive nuclear forces, strategic forces, that could, at a moment's notice, be used without any further consultation with Congress whatsoever.
Do you see any limitation whatsoever under the
President,
Constitution?
The President has the authority in response to an attack, obviously, without consulting with anyone, in a matter of minutes, to use that force, overwhelming force, more force than the United States has ever before employed. That's a realistic reflection of the world we live in. I think the President's limited by the fact that ultimately the kind of policy that he might pursue with respect to the kind of operations you suggest turns upon the willingness of the Congress to support it, turns upon the willingness of the American people to support it.
And that would be after were the fact. Is there anything before the fact?
Were he to use that authority in a way that ultimately was not supported by the United States, the Congress still has the authority, clearly, to cut off funding or otherwise use the power of the purse to terminate the operation.
So before the fact, you see no limitations?
Basically, that's correct.
Scary.
We could get more cooperation out of the Congress in terms of funding for it, but I think the Strategic Defense Initiative is enormously important. I think it's absolutely essential, given any set of assumptions you may want to make about the future world, that we continue to develop that capability and ultimately to deploy it. And I don't see at this point SDI as being even on the table. We have negotiations underway in Geneva under the defense and space talks. We've consistently supported the proposition that what we need is the ability to make a peaceful transition, if you will, an orderly transition to a regime in which defenses play a larger part. But I don't expect that there will ever be an accord, if you will, between President Bush and Mr. Gorbachev, from our perspective, to do away with or in any way limit our efforts in the SDI area.
Sir, my name is Cam Halbid. I teach political science at the Air Force Academy, and I wanted to ask a question about secrecy. I have a strong appreciation for it, having spent 5 years as a constituent of yours at FE Warren as a missile launch officer. But how does the United States government and the executive strike a balance between the need for secrecy on so many things and yet at the same time avoiding a situation in which secrecy becomes so overwhelming that the executive branch occasionally may overstep its bounds?
Well, I guess of course, I have a bias, I suppose, given my current job. I think yours too. I think there are, in fact, legitimate national security considerations that require secrecy. I think there are a great many things that we do that are in the best interest of the nation, that the President and his key advisors ought to be trusted with. I think we have a system in place now that generally works fairly well with respect to notification of the Congress, not the entire Congress, obviously, but selected members of Congress, of those programs or those activities that fall into their area of jurisdiction. Institutionally, I think the balance is about right. I guess the problem I have at present is I'm inclined to believe that secrecy isn't at the heart of the problem so much when we get into difficulties or when an administration gets into difficulties as it is lack of judgment on the part of the individuals involved, or perhaps lack of clear direction from the principals to their subordinates. Secrecy is a necessary part of doing business in the modern world, and if there is on occasion abused, usually there's some more fundamental underlying mistake that's been made in the first place. On balance, at present, I would argue, from my perspective as Secretary of Defense, given my responsibilities, that we have too much trouble maintaining the classification of some things that really ought to be classified and ought to remain that way. We oftentimes, I think, disclose and divulge things, sometimes inadvertently, sometimes it's done deliberately, that do indeed do fundamental damage to the national interest. And I think ultimately, of course, we have to place confidence in the judgment of those we elect to govern. If they don't perform properly, then we always have the opportunity to replace them.
Thanks.
Just one more.
Mr. Secretary, greetings from the great state of Illinois. Recently on TV, there's a law professor who I believe teaches at Harvard in between Geraldo shows, who said in regards to the Noriega trial that it was overwhelming the judicial system, that we were putting the judges into foreign policy, et cetera. And I was wondering if you could discuss that or any thoughts if that's ever come across or in your discussions about the Noriega trial and maybe your prognosis for that situation.
Well, as I explained at the outset, my role basically was on the side of the apprehension of Mr. Noriega. Somebody else has to try him. We've turned it over now to the courts, to the Justice Department. They're moving forward to the prosecution. I have been, I think, I have to be legitimately cautious in terms of comments about the pending case. We felt that it was a legitimate exercise of U.S. power to bring Mr. Noriega to justice. That was not the only reason we sent force into Panama. It was one of four reasons specifically, the others being to protect American lives and American interest and to restore democracy in Panama. But I'll leave it up to the Justice Department to successfully conclude the matter. Thank you all very much.